Why are you still doing this to yourself, Goggins? Because you are one hard motherfucker, I screamed. The voices in my head were so penetrating, I had to bite back out loud. I was on to something. I felt an energy build immediately, as I realized that still being in the fight was a miracle in itself. Except it wasn't a miracle. God didn't come down and bless my ass. I did this. I kept going when I should have quit 5 hours ago. I am the reason I still have a chance. And I remembered something else, too. This wasn't the first time I'd taken on a seemingly impossible task. I picked up my pace. I was still walking, but I wasn't sleepwalking anymore. I had life. I kept digging into my past, into my own imaginary cookie jar. I remembered as a kid, no matter how fucked up our life was, my mother always figured out a way to stock our damn cookie jar. She'd buy wafers and Oreos, Pepperidge Farm Milanos and Chips Ahoy, and whenever she showed up with a new batch of cookies, she'd dump them into one jar. With her permission, we'd get to pick one or two out at a time. It was like a mini treasure hunt. I remember the joy of dropping my fist into that jar, wondering what I'd find, and before I crammed the cookie in my mouth, I always took the time to admire it first, especially when we were broke in Brazil. I'd turn it around in my hand and say my own little prayer of thanks. The feeling of being that kid, locked in a moment of gratitude for a simple gift like a cookie, came back to me. I felt it viscerally, and I used that concept to stuff a new kind of cookie jar. Inside it were all my past victories. Like the time when I had to study 3 times as hard as anybody else during my senior year in high school just to graduate. That was a cookie. Or when I passed the ASVAB test as a senior, and then again to get into BUDS. 2 more cookies. I remembered dropping over 100 pounds in under 3 months, conquering my fear of water, graduating BUDS at the top of my class, and being named Enlisted Honor Man in Army Ranger training. More on that soon. All of those were cookies, loaded with chocolate chunks. These weren't mere flashbacks. I wasn't just floating through my memory files. I actually tapped into the emotional state I felt during those victories, and in so doing, accessed my sympathetic nervous system once again. My adrenaline took over. The pain started to fade just enough, and my pace picked up. I began swinging my arms and lengthening my stride. My fractured feet were still a bloody mess, full of blisters, the toenails peeling off almost every toe, but I kept pounding. And soon it was me who was slaloming runners with pained expressions as I raced the clock. From then on, the cookie jar became a concept I've employed whenever I need a reminder of who I am and what I'm capable of. We all have a cookie jar inside us, because life, being what it is, has always tested us. Even if you're feeling low and beat down by life right now, I guarantee you can think of a time or two when you overcame odds and tasted success. It doesn't have to be a big victory either. It can be something small. I know we all want the whole victory today, but when I was teaching myself to read, I would be happy when I could understand every word in a single paragraph. I knew I still had a long way to go to move from a third grade reading level to that of a senior in high school, but even a small win like that was enough to keep me interested in learning and finding more within myself. You don't drop 100 pounds in less than 3 months without losing 5 pounds in a week first. Those first 5 pounds I lost were a small accomplishment. And it doesn't sound like a lot, but at the time it was proof that I could lose weight and that my goal, however improbable, was not impossible. The engine in a rocket ship does not fire without a small spark first. We all need small sparks, small accomplishments in our lives to fuel the big ones. Think of your small accomplishments as kindling. When you want a bonfire, you don't start by lighting a big log. You collect some witch's hair, a small pile of hay or some dry dead grass. You light that. And then add small sticks, and bigger sticks, before you feed your tree stump into the blaze. Because it's the small sparks, which start small fires, that eventually build enough heat to burn the whole fucking forest down. If you don't have any big accomplishments to draw on yet, so be it. Your small victories are your cookies to savor, and make sure you do savor them. Yeah, I was hard on myself when I looked in the accountability mirror, but I also praised myself whenever I could claim a small victory. Because we all need that, and very few of us take the time to celebrate our successes. Sure, in the moment we might enjoy them, but do we ever look back on them and feel that win again and again? Maybe that sounds narcissistic to you, but I'm not talking about bullshitting about the glory days here. I'm not suggesting you crawl up your own ass and bore your friends with all your stories about what a badass you used to be. Nobody wants to hear that shit. I'm talking about utilizing past successes to fuel you to new and bigger ones. Because in the heat of battle, when shit gets real, we need to draw inspiration to push through our own exhaustion, depression, pain, and misery. We need to spark a bunch of small fires to become the motherfucking inferno. But digging into the cookie jar when things are going south takes focus and determination, because at first the brain doesn't want to go there. It wants to remind you that you're suffering and that your goal is impossible. It wants you to stop so it can stop the pain. That night in San Diego was the most difficult night of my life physically. I'd never felt so broken, and there were no souls to take. I wasn't competing for a trophy. There was no one standing in my way. All I had to draw on to keep myself going was me. The cookie jar became my energy bank. Whenever the pain got to be too much, I dug into it and took a bite. The pain was never gone, but I only felt it in waves because my brain was otherwise occupied, which allowed me to drown out the simple questions and shrink time. Each lap became a victory lap, celebrating a different cookie, another small fire. Mile 81 became 82, and an hour and a half later, I was in the 90s. I'd run 90 fucking miles with no training. Who does that shit? An hour later, I was at 95, and after nearly 19 hours of running almost nonstop, I'd done it. I'd hit 100 miles. Or had I? I couldn't remember, so I ran one more lap, just to make sure. After running 101 miles, my race finally over, I staggered to my lawn chair, and Kate placed a camouflage poncho liner over my body as I shivered in the fog. Steam poured off me. My vision was blurred. I remember feeling something warm on my leg, looked down, and saw I was pissing blood again. I knew what was coming next, but the porta-potties were about 40 feet away, which may as well have been 40 miles, or 4,000. I tried to get up, but I was way too dizzy, and collapsed back into that chair, an immovable object ready to accept the inevitable truth that I was about to shit myself. It was much worse this time. My entire backside and lower back was smeared with warm feces. Kate knew what an emergency looked like. She sprinted to our Toyota Camry and backed the car up on the grassy knoll beside me. My legs were stiff as fossils, frozen in stone, and I leaned on her to slide into the back seat. She was frantic behind the wheel and wanted to take me directly to the ER, but I wanted to go home. We lived on the second deck of an apartment complex in Chula Vista, and I leaned on her back with my arms around her neck as she led me up that staircase. She balanced me up against the stucco as she opened the door to our apartment. I took a few steps inside before blacking out. I came to on the kitchen floor a few minutes later. My back was still smeared with shit, my thighs caked in blood and urine, my feet were blistered up and bleeding in 12 places. 7 of my 10 toenails were dangling loose, connected only by tabs of dead skin. We had a combination tub and shower, and she got the shower going before helping me crawl toward the bathroom and climb into the tub. I remember lying there naked, with the shower pouring down upon me. I shivered, felt and looked like death, and then I started peeing again. But instead of blood or urine, what came out of me looked like thick brown bile. Petrified, Kate stepped into the hall to dial my mom. She'd been to the race with a friend of hers who happened to be a doctor. When he heard my symptoms, the doctor suggested that I might be in kidney failure and that I needed to go to the ER immediately. Kate hung up, stormed into the bathroom, and found me lying on my left side in the fetal position. "We need to get you to the ER now, David." She kept talking, shouting, crying, trying to reach me through the haze, and I heard most of what she said. But I knew if we went to the hospital, they'd give me painkillers, and I didn't want to mask this pain. I'd just accomplished the most amazing feat in my entire life. It was harder than Hell Week, more significant to me than becoming a SEAL, and more challenging than my deployment to Iraq, because this time I had done something I'm not sure anyone had ever done before. I ran 101 miles with zero preparation. I knew then that I'd been selling myself short, that there was a whole new level of performance out there to tap into, that the human body can withstand and accomplish a hell of a lot more than most of us think possible, and that it all begins and ends in the mind. This wasn't a theory. It wasn't something I'd read in a damn book. I'd experienced it firsthand on Hospitality Point. This last part, this pain and suffering, this was my trophy ceremony. I'd earned this. This was confirmation that I'd mastered my own mind, at least for a little while, and that what I'd just accomplished was something special. As I lay there, curled up in the tub, shivering in the fetal position, relishing the pain, I thought of something else, too. If I could run 101 miles with zero training, imagine what I could do with a little preparation. Goggins, man. I mean, what happens when you hear that? Are you right back on Hospitality Point?
That race brings back a lot of memories. I've never in my entire life suffered like that. I didn't know that was even possible to suffer like that. But the one thing I figured out through all that suffering was that it was possible to go so much further than what anybody thinks. Mm. I mean, literally at mile 70, I was done. I was done at mile 50. And to go that much further feeling that bad, it changed my perspective on life. It really did.
And that's directly because of how much suffering there was. I mean, you've told me many times that this is the top suffering of all the amazing things that you've dealt with and all the pain you've dealt with. This is number one.
There's nothing even close to this, man. You know, I was in Hell Week, Ranger School. I'd done tons of things in my life. You know, so at 43, I'd done a lot of shit.
60 ultras or something
like
that?
Yeah, 60 ultras by now. And I look back at this race that was on a flat 1 mile track, and this thing kicked the living hell out of me. You know, when you're not prepared and you go out there strictly on blood and guts, Mileplex and Ritz crackers, you know, that's about the dumbest equation you are bound to fail. You are bound to fail. And to sit back through all that stuff and figure out how to succeed, that's what I get out of that, man. Like, you know, I didn't freak out. You know, I'm at mile 70. I have diarrhea on me, peeing a little bit of blood. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay, you know, I wasn't sitting there thinking, man, I got to pull out of this thing. I was thinking, how can I do this? How can I do this? And I was slowly just getting my mind, and it was truly beautiful. So in the most painful time of my entire life, I saw the most beauty in life. It was so crazy because everything started slowing down because I knew I wasn't going to quit. I knew I wasn't going to quit. And once your mind knows it's not going to quit, something happens. It starts to say, oh, okay, I guess we got to find more. I guess we got to find more. So that's what I realized. If your brain is in control and you are in control of your brain, you will find more.
Challenge 6. Take inventory of your cookie jar. Crack your journal open again. Write it all out. Remember, this is not some breezy stroll through your personal trophy room. Don't just write down your achievement hit list. Include life obstacles you've overcome as well, like quitting smoking or overcoming depression or a stutter. Add in those minor tasks you failed earlier in life, but tried again a second or third time and ultimately succeeded at. Feel what it was like to overcome those struggles, those opponents, and win. Then get to work. Set ambitious goals before each workout and let those past victories carry you to new personal bests. If it's a run or bike ride, include some time to do interval work and challenge yourself to beat your best mile split, or simply maintain a maximum heart rate for a full minute, then 2 minutes. If you're at home, focus on pull-ups or push-ups. Do as many as possible in 2 minutes. Then try to beat your best. When the pain hits and tries to stop you short of your goal, dunk your fist in, pull out a cookie, and let it fuel you. If you're more focused on intellectual growth, train yourself to study harder and longer than ever before, or read a record number of books in a given month. Your cookie jar can help there too, because if you perform this challenge correctly and truly challenge yourself, you'll come to a point in any exercise where pain, boredom, or self-doubt kicks in, and you'll need to push back to get through it. The cookie jar is your shortcut to taking control of your own thought process. Use it that way. The point here isn't to make yourself feel like a hero for the fuck of it. It's not a hooray for me session. It's to remember what a badass you are so you can use that energy to succeed again in the heat of battle. Post your memories and the new successes they fueled on social media and include the hashtags, #can't hurt me, #cookie jar. So, anything you want to expand on here and why you think it's such a good exercise for the readers?
Well, I think we covered it pretty good here, but I do have a story that I will share with the readers or with the listeners. And as we talked about with Marcus and Morgan Luttrell, and the reader or the listener now knows that Marcus and Morgan are twins, and Morgan is 1 minute older than Marcus. So as the story goes, Marcus went to Buzz before Morgan, and Marcus is not a good runner. Marcus is not a good runner. So at this time, Morgan was in college, and Morgan came to visit Marcus. And they're in their room, I think it's Sunday night. So every Monday morning, we have a 04 or 05. We have to meet on the beach for a hard-packed 4 mile time run. So I guess, you know, Marcus has some messed up legs. He was suffering pretty bad. I guess he has some stress fractures. He had a messed up femur. He has just a jacked up bottom half of his body. So it was Morgan, Marcus, and a friend of his from his class, and they came up with an idea. At first, it was a joke. It was a big joke. They said, "Hey, Morgan, you ought to go ahead and be Marcus for a day." And this is one of the greatest Bud stories of all time. And it's a true story. And I won't be able to do it justice because I don't know all the details, but I'll give you the details that I do know. And I actually talked to Morgan, and he said I can share the story with you all. So enjoy this. So we're in, you know, arguably the hardest training, you know, in the world. And these guys pull off one of the best all-time trickeries in the world. So Marcus and Morgan actually switched for the day. Marcus is in his room, hiding out. Morgan, who is not even in the military, let alone SEAL training, he is now posing as Marcus.
He's like a freshman in University of Texas or some shit, right?
Exactly. He's at some university. He comes in to visit, and now Morgan, who knows nothing about the military, is now posing as Marcus for this 4 mile time run. Now, Marcus once again cannot run to save his soul, but he happens to get through Buds. But so Morgan comes in, he does the run for Marcus. No one knows anything but a few guys in his class. Then it's supposed to be over, but Morgan goes on and does the rest of the day. So he does a full day in Buds as Marcus Luttrell. Now look, you're not going to hear that anywhere. You're not going to hear that anywhere but here. So that's a true story about Marcus and Morgan. Those two are thick as thieves, and it's just one of the most amazing stories of all time for Buds.
I loved hearing that story from Morgan when he told us. It was almost like I after the run, he kind of like the day went differently than they'd planned. Right, there was no way for him to get out of there.
Right, he got kind of stuck being Marcus the whole day. So yeah, I forgot about that. You are right.
Didn't the leadership eventually find out and like award him like some, like they honored him at the graduation, or no? Am I imagining that?
Oh no, you're not imagining anything. So what happened was Marcus graduated. I think he graduated in 228. Yeah, he was 228 because I was 230. I was his Hoo-Yah class. So he graduated in 228. So literally 9 classes later in 237, here comes Morgan. So by now, after 9 classes, all the instructors now know that Morgan was posing as Marcus. So when Morgan comes in, they beat the living shit out of Morgan. But Morgan graduates, you know, they actually, you know, thought it was kind of funny. But he, I think Morgan got honor man in class 237, but he got beat badly for that incident.
So there was nothing that was public, but they just told him privately they knew what happened.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. It was funny. Hee hee ha ha. We're going to beat the shit out of you type of shit.
That's amazing. Yeah. Great story. Oh, that's like a, you know, all time Bud stunt right there.
You know what? It was great. I wasn't around to see it. I don't know. Surprisingly, I was in Buds for like 10 years, you know. Buzz is 6 months, and I was there for like 18 months, man. So it was a brutal time for David Goggins.
Oh, man. Well, what an amazing story. The San Diego One Day is an all-timer as well. And we just keep going because it just keeps getting more. You get more and more mental mastery as you start developing your principles more and more now as you go through your life. Isn't that right?
You know what? And that's the whole sickness of all of this, man. And I hope that people, as they're reading this, you know, as they're listening to this book and also reading the book, that they start to realize you can come from absolutely nothing And it wasn't like somebody came down and had all these great trainers and these great psychiatrists and these great teachers. You can literally do it on your own. But you have to accept a whole bunch of shit to do that. You don't need all these special tools. The tool, the most powerful tool in the world, is the one that I continue to come back to. And that is your mind. We have to learn to put all these phones down, all these computers, and start to really use your mind. It's the most powerful weapon in the world.
And that's where we go next. And we're going to get into the 40% rule, which I know is really popular with your followers and will be with readers as well and listeners. So I'm really excited to share that with you next time. We're going to sign off for day two here from the studio. And looking forward to day three.
All right, man. We'll see you all tomorrow.
All right. Here we are, day three, audiobook / podcast / experimental media.
So true, man. Never been done before. So this is, I never do anything like anybody else does it.
Yeah. And this is a really fun experience. I hope the listener's enjoying it. Just being able to talk it out in real time as we read through it. I find it, that's fun for me and keeps it fresh, I think, as well. And it must be kind of a trip for you to hear your life story that you wrote read back to you.
Oh, it is crazy. I mean, it's, I sit back and sometimes I'm speechless and you ask me a question and this is totally, we're having a conversation, me and you. This is off the cuff. This isn't rehearsed. And some of the questions you may ask me, man, I'm sitting back thinking, good God, man, did I really go through that shit?
And
we'll get to all the interviews we had because so many stories we have in here, a lot of people may say, oh, that shit didn't happen or that didn't happen. And we interviewed, 30 people?
Yeah.
Around there?
At least that.
Yeah. So, we had a lot of people interviewed because every story that's in this book is, I had to make sure that it was validated,
Yeah. And I mean, the fact checking was done and every story has been validated. We talked, I actually went and visited the Buds compound.
Yep.
And speaking with some of your ex, platoon, mates and a lot of people who aren't even in the book that we spoke to.
Right. We have Drew Sheets that we talked about in the last chapter.
Yep.
Or he went in the last chapter. I just kind of brought up Drew Sheets at the very end and, we talked to him for about 2 hours.
Yeah.
And didn't even use his material because we had so much in here.
Yeah. And there's more like him. Before we start, getting into chapter 7, which I think is a really pivotal chapter here, cause it encapsulates something that I know is extremely important to you just in terms of the mind and how powerful it is and how many of us don't tap into its full power. And I know we want to get into that, but you wanted to talk about something else before that.
Yeah. The whole big thing I'd like to talk about, before we get into, the mind is procrastination. And I was just thinking about this morning. I had this guy in the gym, he came up to me when I was leaving. He's like, hey, are you David Goggins? And I'm like, yeah, I'm David Goggins. He goes, I'm going to go run a 50 miler one day. I'm going to do a 50 miler one day. And I'm like, hey man, why don't you go online, Google some 50 milers and sign up for it. He's like, well, I need to, get a big, big training block, maybe put a year of training into it. And I'm sitting there thinking the whole time, man, that's exactly what people do, is they like to have their mind fool them. I need so much preparation. I need so much training. I need so much time. And all that does is he will sit back and he'll start procrastinating on that same idea. So that's what brought the whole, procrastinating thing up.
Yeah. Well, as a writer, I know procrastination rather well. It's part of the deal.
Right.
But, I don't love it. It's definitely something that I do, indulge in too much sometimes. Sometimes the power of a deadline makes it, the deadline is kind of this hammer that's kind of ready to swing. So you can't procrastinate when the deadline is kind of breathing down your neck.
Right.
But there are some people who think consider procrastination to be part of the process, certainly in a creative work where, sometimes you're just not ready. It might mean that you haven't really thought out all the beats to a story or to a song, and you do need to kind of, mull it over. And even if you're not thinking of it consciously, there's an unconscious part of you that's still mulling it over. And it's this natural process that we all, tap into sometimes. But I think the same is also true, that's only true. Procrastination is only a productive process if you eventually produce the material, which means getting your ass to work.
Right. And you know what happens during procrastination, that so-called phase that some theorists think that you need is, you start overthinking. And then when you start overthinking something, man, you start going down that serious spiral of, oh, you know what? Maybe I'm not good enough. Maybe I shouldn't do it. And the one thing that helped me out so much was I pushed myself so far back in the corner when I was almost 300 pounds. I'm like, hey, I'm going to go be a Navy SEAL. I had the bright idea to go try to be a Navy SEAL. And when that recruiter told me, hey, you have under 3 months to lose 106 pounds, I didn't have that whole phase of procrastination that people say you're supposed to go through, that phase got eliminated.
Yes, but there was that. I have to push back just to see what you say about this, though. Because remember, you did in your mind say, well, listen, I'm going to do the ASVAB part of it first. And you did that 2 weeks before you started to really get into your running routine.
Right.
You were still on the cockroach duty and you were doing the ASVAB. That kind of was your little procrastination piece, wasn't it?
You know, I guess you can call it procrastination, but for me to go back to the ASVAB test,
yeah,
I'd rather run 400 million miles than sit my butt down and start studying for the ASVAB test again.
So you were just cramming the whole time.
Right. So for me, how my mind works is a lot of us, we are, especially nowadays, people can multitask big time.
Yeah.
Which to me makes you half-assed at a lot of shit.
Yeah.
I have to, so my brain, the way it works, if I don't put all of my time and energy to what's in front of me, I have to be hyper focused and put everything. So I put everything into studying. Mm. Everything had to be into studying. Cause if I was half-assed in my studying and then going out and then trying to work out, my mind would have been split into two spots and that wouldn't have been great for me. So I knew that I had to put a lot of time into learning, you know, this ASVAB book again.
And you had that, even though you didn't pass that, that became the base level, which then you were able to kind of supplement as you started to work out hard on the exercise bike. But you already kind of laid a foundation for the supplementing of the studying.
Exactly. Because without the ASVAB, I could lose 200 pounds.
Right.
I wasn't getting in the military.
No.
So that was the first big step.
Yeah. I mean, I just started thinking of something. It's like, so many of us are so busy multitasking, we don't do shit.
Exactly. It's a true statement. Nowadays, these millennials, man, they can multitask their ass off. You know, and that's kind of old school knuckle draggers, man. You know, we're like fixed pointed on one object and get after it. And there's another thing I want to talk about before we get going in the book is I'm all about change. I'm really about change. When I had a fixed mindset, a fixed mindset to me is one of the worst mindsets you can possibly have. And we change our life, you know, so in our lives, we change our house, we change our car, we change our clothes, we change our hairstyle. Sometimes we change our wives, our husbands, you know, we change so much, but very rarely do we change the way we think. And that right there is what I realized throughout this whole book. If I didn't change the way I thought about what was in front of me, about all the obstacles that, you know, whatever put in front of me, God put in front of me, people put in front of me, I put in front of me. If I didn't change the way I thought about, let me take a step back and figure out how I can go through it, or around it, or over it, versus saying, oh, I see a wall, let me just stop. Hmm. Now when I see a wall, I look for a door. I look for a window. I look for a way. I look for a little crack to say, maybe I can chip away at that wall to get through it. So that's how my mind's now. My mind is not like I see a wall, and obviously the wall is something that we have in our mind that then says, oh, I'm going to stop right here because this is just too much. I'm open-minded to believe that there's a way through that wall. Hmm. And that's something about, you know, with procrastination, with mindset, with change. We have to change the way we think. And very few of us are willing to do that.
Yeah, and what I love about the way you're approaching this is you're not pointing the finger and saying, you don't do this, I do this, you don't do what I do. No, you've lived through all of this. You've done all of these things. You have procrastinated. You have doubted yourself.
Yeah.
You have succumbed to self-doubt.
Right.
You have been backed into the corner that you put yourself in.
Exactly.
And then you also rose out of it because you were able to systematically shift how you approached your own mind.
And you know what? And that's why I talk about it so much, Adam, is I'm not this guy who's like, you know, calling people out,
no.
Judging people. No, man, I know exactly where the hell you're at. If you're going through a problem mentally, 9 times out of 10, I've been exactly where you're at. So I'm not judging you. I'm trying to give you tips on how to get through that daggone obstacle, which is your mind. And a lot of people think I'm crazy. Nah, I'm not crazy. I'm just not like you. That's all it is. I'm just not like you. So once again, it goes back to the title. Trying to put a title on something that you don't understand. I'm not crazy. We're just different people, and I'm just not like you. But we have a lot more to cover here, man. I'm looking forward to hearing the next chapter.
Chapter 7, The Most Powerful Weapon. 27 hours after savoring intense, gratifying pain and basking in the afterglow of my greatest achievement so far, I was back at my desk on a Monday morning. SBG was my commanding officer, and I had his permission and every known excuse to take a few days off. Instead, swollen, sore, and miserable, I pulled myself out of bed, hobbled into work, and later that morning, called Chris Kossman. I've been looking forward to this. I imagined the sweet note of surprise in his voice after hearing that I'd taken his challenge and run 101 miles in less than 24 hours. Perhaps there'd even be some overdue respect as he made my entry to Badwater official. Instead, my call went to voicemail. I left him a polite message he never returned, and 2 days later, I dropped him an email. Sir, how are you doing? I ran the 100 miles needed to qualify in 18 hours and 56 minutes. I would like to know now what I need to do to get into the Badwater, so we can begin raising money for the Special Operations Warrior Foundation. Thanks again. His reply came in the next day, and it threw me way the fuck off. Congrats on your 100-mile finish. But did you actually stop then? The point of a 24-hour event is to run for 24 hours. Anyway, stay tuned for the announcement that you can apply. The race will be July 24th to the 26th. Best regards, Chris Kossman. I couldn't help but take his response personally. On a Wednesday, he suggested I run 100 miles in 24 hours that Saturday. I got it done in less time than he required, and he still wasn't impressed. Kossman was a veteran of ultra races, so he knew that strewn behind me were a dozen performance barriers and pain thresholds I'd shattered. Obviously, none of that meant much to him. I cooled off for a week before I rode him back, and in the meantime looked into other races to bolster my resume. There were very few available that late in the year. I found a 50-miler on Catalina, but only triple digits would impress a guy like Kossman. Plus, it had been a full week since the San Diego One Day, and my body was still monumentally fucked. I hadn't run 3 feet since finishing mile 101. My frustration flashed with the cursor as I crafted my rebuttal. Thanks for emailing me back. I see that you enjoy talking about as much as I do. The only reason why I'm still bugging you is because this race and the cause behind it is important. If you have any other qualifying races that you think I should do, please let me know. Thanks for letting me know I'm supposed to run the full 24 hours. Next time, I'll be sure to do that. It took him another full week to respond, and he didn't offer a hell of a lot more hope, but at least he salted it with sarcasm. Hi, David. If you could do some more ultras between now and January 3rd to the 24th, the application period, great. If not, submit the best possible application during the January 3rd to 24th window and cross your fingers. Thanks for your enthusiasm. Chris. At this point, I was starting to like Chris Kossman a lot better than my chances of getting into Badwater. What I didn't know, because he never mentioned it, is that Kossmann was one of the five people on the Badwater Admissions Committee, which reviews upwards of 1,000 applications a year. Each judge scores every application, and based on their cumulative scores, the top 90 applicants get in on merit. From the sounds of it, my resume was thin. I wouldn't crack the top 90. On the other hand, Kossmann held 10 wild cards in his back pocket. He could have already guaranteed me a spot, but for some reason he kept pushing me. Once again, I'd have to prove myself beyond a minimum standard to get a fair shake. To become a SEAL, I had to deal with 3 hell weeks. And now, if I really wanted to run Badwater and raise money for families in need, I was going to have to find a way to make my application bulletproof. Based on a link he sent along with his reply, I found one more ultra race scheduled before the Badwater application was due. It was called the Hurt 100, and the name did not lie. One of the toughest 100-mile trail races in the world, it was set in a triple canopy rainforest on the island of Oahu. To cross the finish line, I'd have to run up and down 24,500 vertical feet. That's some Himalayan shit. I stared at the race profile. It was all sharp spikes and deep dives. It looked like an arrhythmic EKG. I couldn't do this race cold. There's no way I could finish it without at least some training, but by early December, I was still in so much agony that walking up the stairs to my apartment was pure torture. The following weekend, I zoomed up Interstate 15 to Vegas for the Las Vegas Marathon. It wasn't spur of the moment. Months before I'd ever heard the word San Diego one day, Kate, my mom, and I had circled December 5th on our calendars. It was 2005, the first year that the Las Vegas Marathon started on the Strip, and we wanted to be part of that shit. Except I never trained for it. Then the San Diego one day happened, and by the time we got to Vegas, I had no illusions about my fitness level. I tried to run the morning before we left, but I still had stress fractures in my feet. My medial tendons were wobbly, and even while wrapped with a special bandage I'd found that could stabilize my ankles, I couldn't last longer than a quarter mile. So I didn't plan on running as we rocked up to the Mandalay Bay Casino and Resort on race day. It was a beautiful morning. Music was pumping. There were thousands of smiling faces in the street. The clean desert air had a chill to it, and the sun was shining. Running conditions don't get much better, and Kate was ready to go. Her goal was to break 5 hours, and for once, I was satisfied being a cheerleader. My mom had always planned on walking it, and I figured I'd stroll with her for as long as I could, then hail a cab to the finish line and cheer my ladies to the tape. The three of us towed up with the masses as the clock struck 7 a.m., and someone got on the mic to begin the official countdown. 10, 9, 8. When he hit 1, a horn sounded, and like Pavlov's dog, something clicked inside me. I still don't know what it was. Perhaps I underestimated my competitive spirit. Maybe it was because I knew Navy SEALs were supposed to be the hardest motherfuckers in the world. We were supposed to run on broken legs and fractured feet. Or so went the legend I bought into long ago. Whatever it was, something triggered, and the last thing I remember seeing as the horn echoed down the street was shock and real concern on the faces of Kate and my mother as I charged down the boulevard and out of sight. The pain was serious for the first quarter mile, but after that, adrenaline took over. I hit the first mile marker at 7:10 and kept running like the asphalt was melting behind me. 10 kilometers into the race, my time was around 43 minutes. That's solid. But I wasn't focused on the clock, because considering how I'd felt the day before, I was still in total disbelief that I'd actually run 6.2 miles. My body was broken. How was this happening? Most people in my condition would have both feet in soft casts, and here I was running a marathon. I got to mile 13, the halfway point, and saw the official clock. It read 1 hour, 35 minutes, 55 seconds. I did the math and realized that I was in the hunt to qualify for the Boston Marathon, but was right on the cusp. In order to qualify in my age group, I had to finish in under 3 hours, 10 minutes, and 59 seconds. I laughed in disbelief and slammed a paper cup of Gatorade. In less than 2 hours, the game had flipped, and I might never get this chance again. I'd seen so much death by then, in my personal life and on the battlefield, that I knew tomorrow was not guaranteed. Before me was an opportunity, and if you give me an opportunity, I will break that motherfucker off. It wasn't easy. I'd surfed an adrenaline wave for the first 13 miles, but I felt every inch of the second half, and at mile 18, I hit a wall. That's a common theme in marathon running, because mile 18 is usually when a runner's glycogen levels run low, and I was bonking, my lungs heaving. My legs felt like I was running in deep Saharan sand. I needed to stop and take a break, but I refused, and 2 hard miles later, I felt rejuvenated. I reached the next clock at mile 22. I was still in the hunt for Boston, though I'd fallen 30 seconds off the pace, and to qualify, the final 4 miles would have to be my very best. I dug deep, kicked my thighs up high, and lengthened my stride. I was a man possessed as I turned the final corner and charged toward the finish line at the Mandalay Bay. Thousands of people had assembled on the sidewalk cheering. It was all a beautiful blur to me as I sprinted home. I ran my last 2 miles at a sub-7-minute pace, finished the race in just over 3 hours and 8 minutes, and qualified for Boston. Somewhere on the streets of Las Vegas, my wife and mother would deal with their own struggles and overcome them to finish too, and as I sat on a patch of grass waiting for them, I contemplated another simple question I couldn't shake. It was a new one, and wasn't fear-based, pain-spiked, or self-limiting. This one felt open. What am I capable of? SEAL training had pushed me to the brink several times, but whenever it beat me down, I popped up to take another pounding. That experience made me hard, but it also left me wanting more of the same, and day-to-day Navy SEAL life just wasn't like that. Then came San Diego one day, and now this. I'd finished a marathon at an elite pace for a weekend warrior, when I had no business even walking a mile. Both were incredible physical feats that didn't seem possible, but they'd happened. What am I capable of? I couldn't answer that question, but as I looked around the finish line that day and considered what I'd accomplished, it became clear that we are all leaving a lot of money on the table without realizing it. We habitually settle for less than our best, at work, in school, in our relationships, and on the playing field or race course. We settle as individuals, and we teach our children to settle for less than their best, and all of that ripples out, merges and multiplies within our communities and society as a whole. We're not talking some bad weekend in Vegas, no more cash at the ATM kind of loss either. In that moment, the cost of missing out on so much excellence in this eternally fucked up world felt incalculable to me. And it still does. I haven't stopped thinking about it since. David, you want to talk about that a little bit?
I do. This was this set the bar to a whole new level for me. And I started realizing right here, the one thing that separates all of us is our mindset. And I was open-minded to the possibility that I had the ability to conquer anything.
This is kind of where it first starts to, like, you even open it even wider beyond, because up until this point, you're still working within a template of the Navy SEAL template, which is, this is the Navy SEALs telling you, no, you're bigger than this. We'll get you to the point where you can fill our box.
Right.
But now you're breaking out of that box.
And that's what I started realizing was exactly what you said. When you become a Navy SEAL, you believe that is the pinnacle of mental toughness, of mental hardness, of you're the baddest of the bad. And I started realizing I hadn't even tapped into the beginning of this journey yet. Mm-hmm. And the first 100-mile race I did was zero training. And then this marathon, being able to run that fast. And I'm telling you right now, those of you who are listening, I was so broken. Like the day before, I could not, no way in hell, run a quarter of a mile. And I know people, oh yeah, right. There's no way in hell. So you can run 26.2 miles. Mm. That's exactly what kind of flipped me out. I realized I was leaving, just like we put here, I was leaving so much on the daggone table, and those questions did come up in my mind. What the hell? If I'm able to do all these things just off of changing my mindset, just off of, you know, going out there and believing, but it's much more than believing, much more than believing, just realizing that I'm not using all of my mind. And I realized that, and it kept on getting worse and worse and worse as I went.
And a lot of us aren't, which we're going to get into in more detail here. But I like this idea of it's not just you, it's everyone. And what is that? And we all know this world, this society, it's not running tip top.
No.
You know, we got a lot of problems out here. And, imagine what we could do if everyone was at the top of their game, if everyone was pushing harder. To me, it seems like things would be happier. I mean, maybe that's just pie in the sky. We don't really know. But to me, it seems like if this is the way things are, this is the status quo, then, and if everyone starts pushing a little harder, doing a little bit more for themselves and for others, I mean, what would happen?
You know what?
And what are we capable of, basically?
Right. And that is it. And I found true happiness on the other end of suffering. And a lot of us, we have to stop giving in to that feeling in our mind that says stop. And it's all relative. But you have to stop. Like when that mind starts telling you to stop, trust me, there's a lot left in the tank. And everybody wants to find peace. That's one thing about life. We all want to find peace so fast, but we don't want to go through, you know, all that hard stuff to find peace. Now, if hard stuff is kind of doing some of the stuff I did, and I'm not saying go out there and run 100 miles, run 200 miles, go through SEAL training, but you cannot leave so much in the tank and just live a normal life. You have to explore yourself, explore your mind, explore your body, explore your soul, explore the limits to the human soul. And that's what it's all about in life.
Physically, I bounced back from Vegas within a few days, meaning I was back to my new normal, dealing with the same serious yet tolerable pain I'd come home to after the San Diego one day. The aches were still there by the following Saturday, but I was done convalescing. I needed to start training, or I'd burn out on the trail during the Hurt 100, and there would be no Badwater. I'd been reading up on how to prepare for ultras, and knew it was vital to get in some 100-mile weeks. I only had about a month to build my strength and endurance before race day on January 14th. My feet and shins weren't even close to right, so I came up with a new method to stabilize both the bones in my feet and my tendons. I bought high-performance inserts, cut them down to fit flush with the soles of my feet, and taped my ankles, heels, and lower shins with compression tape. I also slid a small heel wedge into my shoes to correct my running posture and ease pressure. After what I'd endured, it took a lot of props to get me running nearly pain-free. Getting 100-mile weeks in while holding down a steady job isn't easy, but that was no excuse. My 16-mile commute to work from Chula Vista to Coronado became my go-to run. Chula Vista had a split personality when I lived there. There was the nicer, newer, middle-class section where we lived, which was surrounded by a concrete jungle of gritty, dangerous streets. That's the part I ran through at dawn, beneath freeway overpasses and alongside Home Depot shipping bays. This was not your tourist brochure's version of sunny San Diego. I sniffed car exhaust and rotting garbage, spotted skittering rats, and dodged sleepless homeless camps before reaching Imperial Beach, where I picked up the 7-mile Silver Strand bike path. It banked south past Coronado's landmark hotel, the turn-of-the-century Hotel Del Coronado, and a crop of luxury condo towers which overlooked the same wide strip of sand, shared by Naval Special Warfare Command, where I spent the day jumping out of airplanes and shooting guns. I was living the Navy SEAL legend, trying to keep it real. I ran that 16-mile stretch at least 3 times a week. Some days I ran home too, and on Fridays I added a ruck run. Inside the radio pouch of my standard-issue rucksack, I slid 2 25-pound weights and ran fully loaded for as many as 20 miles to build quad strength. I loved waking up at 5 a.m. and starting work with 3 hours of cardio already in the bank while most of my teammates hadn't even finished their coffee. It gave me a mental edge, a better sense of self-awareness, and a ton of self-confidence, which made me a better SEAL instructor. That's what getting up at the ass crack of dawn and putting out will do for you. It makes you better in all facets of your life. During my first real deal week of training, I ran 77 miles. The following week, I ran 109 miles, including a 12-mile run on Christmas Day. The next week, I pushed it to 111.5, including a 19-mile run on New Year's Day. And the following week, I backed off to taper my legs, but still got 56.5 miles in. All of those were road miles, but what I had coming up was a trail run, and I had never run on a trail before. I bushwhacked a bunch, but I hadn't run distance on single track with a clock running. The Hurt 100 was a 20-mile circuit course, and I'd heard that only a slim slice of those who start the race finish all 5 laps. This was my last chance to pad my Badwater resume. I had a lot riding on a successful outcome, and there was so much about the race and about ultra running that I still didn't know. I flew into Honolulu a few days early and checked into the Halakoa, a military hotel where active duty and veterans stay with their families when they come through town. I'd studied the maps and knew the basics when it came to the terrain, but I hadn't seen it up close. So I drove over to the Hawaii Nature Center the day before the race and stared into the velvety Jade Mountains. All I could see was a steep cut of red earth disappearing into the dense green. I walked up the trail for a half mile, but there was only so far I could hike. I was tapering, and the first mile was straight uphill. Everything beyond that would have to remain a mystery for a little longer. There were just 3 aid stations on the 20-mile course, and most athletes were self-reliant and dialed in their own nutritional regimen. I was still a neophyte and had no clue what I needed when it came to fuel. I met a woman at the hotel at 5:30 a.m. on race day morning, as we were about to leave. She knew I was a rookie and asked what I'd brought with me to keep myself going. I showed her my meager stash of flavored energy gels and my Camelback. "You didn't bring salt pills?" she asked, shocked. I shrugged. I didn't know what the fuck a salt pill was. She poured 100 of them into my palm. "Take 2 of these every hour. They'll keep you from cramping." "Roger that." She smiled and shook her head like she could see my fucked up future. I had a strong start and felt great, but not long after the race began, I knew I was facing a monster course. I'm not talking about the grade and elevation variance. I expected that. It was all the rocks and roots that took me by surprise. I was lucky that it hadn't rained in a couple of days, because all I had to wear were my standard running shoes, which had precious little tread. Then my Camelback broke at mile 6. I shook it off and kept hammering, but without a water source, I'd have to rely on the aid stations to hydrate, and they were spaced miles apart. I didn't even have my support crew of 1 yet. Kate was chilling on the beach and didn't plan on showing up until later in the race, which was my own fault. I enticed her to come along by promising a vacation, and early that morning I insisted she enjoy Hawaii and leave the suffering to me. With or without a Camelback, my mindset was to make it from aid station to aid station and see what happens. Before the race started, I heard people talking about Carl Meltzer. I'd seen him stretching out and warming up. His nickname was the Speed Goat, and he was trying to become the first person ever to complete the race in less than 24 hours. For the rest of us, there was a 36-hour time limit. My first lap took 4.5 hours, and I felt okay afterwards, which was to be expected considering all the long days I'd done in preparation. But I was also concerned, because each lap demanded an ascent and descent of around 5,000 vertical feet, and the amount of focus it took to pay attention to every step so I didn't turn an ankle amped up my mental fatigue. Each time my medial tendon twinged, it felt like a raw nerve exposed to the wind, and I knew one stumble could fold my wobbly ankle and end my race. I felt that pressure every single moment, and as a result, I burned more calories than expected, which was a problem because I had very little fuel, and without a water source, I couldn't hydrate effectively. Between laps, I guzzled water, and with my belly sloshing, started my second loop with a slow jog up that 1-mile-long, 800-foot climb into the mountains, basically straight uphill. That's when it started to rain. Our red earth trail became mud within minutes. The soles of my shoes were coated with it and slick as skis. I sloshed through shin-deep puddles, skidded down descents, and slipped on ascents. It was a full-body sport, but at least there was water. Whenever I was dry, I tipped my head back, opened wide, and tasted the rain, which filtered through a triple-canopy jungle that smelled of leaf rot and shit. The feral funk of fertility invaded my nostrils, and all I could think of was the fact that I had to run 4 more fucking laps. At mile 30, my body reported some positive news. Or maybe it was the physical manifestation of a backhanded compliment. The tendon pain in my ankles had vanished because my feet had swollen enough to stabilize those tendons. Was this a good thing long term? Probably not, but you take what you can get on the ultra circuit, where you have to roll with whatever gets you from mile to mile. Meanwhile, my quads and calves ached like they'd been thumped with a sledgehammer. Yeah, I had done a lot of running, but most of it, including my ruck runs, on pancake flat terrain in San Diego, not on slick jungle trails. Kate was waiting for me by the time I completed my second lap, and after spending a relaxing morning on Waikiki Beach, she watched in horror as I materialized from the mist like a zombie from The Walking Dead. I sat and guzzled as much water as I could. By then, word had gotten out that it was my first trail race. Have you ever had a very public fuck-up, or were in the midst of a shitty day, week, month, year? Yet people around you felt obliged to comment on the source of your humiliation? Maybe they reminded you of all the ways you could have ensured a very different outcome. Now imagine consuming that negativity, but having to run 60 more miles in the sweaty jungle rain on top of it. Does that sound like fun? Yeah, I was the talk of the race. Well, me and Carl Meltzer. Nobody could believe he was gunning for a sub-24-hour experience, and it was equally baffling that I showed up to one of the most treacherous trail races on the planet, undersupplied and unprepared, with no trail races under my belt. By the time I began my third loop, there were only 40 athletes out of nearly 100 left in the race, and I started running with a guy named Luis Escobar. For the 10th time, I heard the following words. "So, it's your first trail race," he asked. I nodded. "You really picked the wrong..." "I know," I said. "It's just such a technical right. I'm a fucking idiot. I've heard that a lot today." "That's okay," he said. "We're all a bunch of idiots out here, man." He handed me a water bottle. He was carrying three of them. "Take this. I heard about your Camelback." This being my second race, I was starting to understand the rhythm of ultra. It's a constant dance between competition and camaraderie, which reminded me of buds. Luis and I were both racing the clock and each other, but we wanted one another to make it. We were in it alone, together, and he was right. We were a couple of fucking idiots. Darkness descended and left us with a pitch-black jungle night. Running side by side, the glow of our headlamps merged and shed a wider light. But once we separated, all I could see was a yellow ball bouncing on the trail ahead of me. Countless tripwires, shin-high logs, slick roots, lichen-wrapped rocks remained out of sight. I slipped, stumbled, fell, and cursed. Jungle noises were everywhere. It wasn't just the insect world that had my attention. In Hawaii, on all the islands, bow hunting for wild pig in the mountains is a major pastime, and master hunters often leave their pit bulls chained up in the jungle to develop a nose for swine. I heard every one of those hungry bulls snapping and growling, and I heard some pigs squealing too. I smelled their fear and rage, their piss and shit, their sour fucking breath. With each nearby bark or yelp, my heart skipped, and I jumped on terrain so slick that injury was a real possibility. One wrong step could roll my ass out of the race and out of contention for Badwater. I could picture Kosman hearing the news and nodding like he figured that shit would happen all along. I know him pretty well now, and he was never out to get me, but that's how my mind worked back then. And in the steep, dark mountains of Oahu, my exhaustion magnified my stress. I felt close to my absolute limit, but still had more than 40 miles to go. On the backside of the course, after a long technical descent into the dark, dank forest, I saw another headlamp circling ahead of me and a cutout on the trail. The runner was moving in curlicues, and when I caught up to him, I could see it was a Hungarian runner I'd met in San Diego named Akos Konya. He was one of the best runners in the field on Hospitality Point, where he covered 134 miles in 24 hours. I liked Akos and had mad respect for him. I stopped and watched him move in conjoining circles, covering the same terrain over and over again. Was he looking for something? Was he hallucinating? "Akos," I asked. "You okay, man? Do you need some help?"
"David, no. I know. I'm fine," he said.
His eyes were full moon flying saucers. He was in delirium, but I was barely hanging on myself and wasn't sure what I could do for him other than tell staff at the next aid station he was wandering in a daze. Like I said, there's camaraderie and there's competition on the ultra circuit, and since he wasn't in obvious pain and refused my help, I had to go into barbarian mode. With two full laps to go, I had no choice but to keep moving. I staggered back to the start line and slumped into my chair, dazed. It was dark as space, the temperature was dropping, and rain was still pissing down. I was at the very edge of my capability and wasn't sure that I could take one more step. I felt like I drained 99% from my tank, at least. My gas light was on, my engine shuddering, yet I knew I had to find more if I was going to finish this race and get myself into bad water. But how do you push yourself when pain is all you feel with every step? When agony is the feedback loop that permeates each cell in your body, begging you to stop? That's tricky, because the threshold for suffering is different for everybody. What's universal is the impulse to succumb, to feel like you've given everything you can and that you are justified in leaving a job undone.